Hi, and thank you for listening to this week's episode of Hereabouts, Asian American Midwest Radio. Hereabouts is produced by WFHB and Indiana University's Asian Culture Center. We ask critical questions about identity, culture, community, and shared assumptions. We air every other Wednesday from 5:30 to 6:30 in the evening. My name is Molly Tai, and I will be facilitating this episode of Hereabouts. Today, we will be talking about the wildfires in Maui and the Maui Forum event hosted by the First Nations Educational and Culture Center. Today, we're meeting with two students from IU Bloomington to hear about their experience. Thank you for being here today.
Hello, my name's Kane Eller. I'm a third year here at IU. I study a public management leadership at the O'Neill School of Public and Environmental Affairs. I'm from the Lummi, Upper Skagit, Nooksack Nations, whose traditional territories lie within what is now known as Washington State in British Columbia. And I'm, you know, my kind of connection to this whole thing is the connections between Coast Salish communities and our the impacts that we feel from wildfires as a result of wide-scale planetary ecological changes. And so we have this kind of point of connection with our relatives further out into the Pacific.
My name is Joshua K. Kolaru. I am Native Hawaiian or Kanaka Maoli. My family originates from the island of Maui in the moku of Wailuku. I've grown up in Indiana. I'm at IU currently pursuing a degree in environmental management, and I am working on a career in wildfire directly, and I have a lot of friends and contacts who are out deployed on fires right now.
Thank you both for being here. We really appreciate you taking the time. For those who may not know what is currently happening, can you provide our listeners with an overview of the current situation regarding the wildfires in Maui?
Yeah. So basically, a month and a half ago at this point, there was a brush fire on the island of Maui on the side of the dry side of the island, basically. And the wildfire got out of control and it moved into the historic town of Lahaina, which is the old capital of the Kingdom of Hawaii. It reduced the town to rubble, and proper evacuation procedures, you know, were not followed. And a lot of people lost their life. There is catastrophic loss of life. And this falls into, I think, a bigger pattern of environmental racism and imperialism and colonialism around the world that, you know, people of the global South are paying for this upfront.
Thank you for telling us about that. So these wildfires have really had a devastating impact on the environment and local communities. Can you describe some of the immediate and the long-term effects that they've had on the island and the inhabitants?
Yeah, the biggest thing, I mean, right now is the loss of life is absolutely devastating and irreparable. It, like, a massive scar has been left on this community. And, you know, to top it all off, Hawaii already deals with a massive housing issue, where Native Hawaiians are disproportionately affected by it and are homeless on our own traditional homelands. The long-term effects of this are going to be ensuring that the people who have lost their homes get to keep their land. I think there's a big risk right now of them being bought out and forced off their land because, you know, Lahaina is not going to be built for many, many years at this point. And ensuring that, you know, people don't have to give up the land that they've been on for hundreds and hundreds of years because of something that was out of their control.
Yeah, that's, like, to add to that, like, I think that this is kind of a repeat of trends we've seen in the past, like throughout history. Catastrophes happen and people take advantage of them, especially when you, like, put in the dynamic of, like, the colonized versus colonizing forces of people. You know, in my territories, we have similar fires that drive people out of their homes. And, you know, same in Pacific Northwest, we have a large tourist economy. People come and they like to see the mountains and they like to see the rainforests and they like to see all the good backpacking spots. And, you know, like where I'm from, Port Angeles, Washington, while we've had no fires or any catastrophes on the level of what happened in Lahaina, you know, the economic impacts of that tourism is shown. You know, most of my hometown is now Airbnbs. The community that I grew up in as a small child is not what it was, you know, 8 to 10 years ago. The houses are shells for backpackers and tourists. And, you know, I mean, this is the, when I think of my hometown, I see what could happen in Lahaina, you know, with this tragedy, people coming in and rebuilding a town of Airbnbs and displacing the indigenous people who, you know, have always lived there.
Well, I think it's important to also say that what you just described is not something, is not a hypothetical of what could happen. Honestly, it is something that has been happening, you know, since Airbnb got created, is, you know, people from the States have been buying up housing in just the entire kingdom of Hawaii and keeping that housing out of the hands of people who do live there and been pricing them out of their own homes. And if it hasn't been Airbnb, then it's been these massive, you know, resorts and even like billionaires themselves. Oprah has, and Mark Zuckerberg have both bought huge swaths of land on our islands. And you know, the trouble with that is it is a literally an island. You know, you get priced out of your land, you know, you're on your own really. And it's tough. I think the biggest thing is I'm really worried about it being exacerbated by this fire. It's pretty clear, I think, how vulnerable the community already is to this and how something like this is really only going to facilitate something that's already been happening.
Yeah, and I would agree. That's why, yeah, it's indicative of larger trends, you know, and trends seen throughout, especially, like I said, areas that are prone to tourism that are indigenous lands that are colonized. Because, yeah, I mean, it's larger than just the Airbnbs. I mean, even before tourist economy, you know, it was the loggers, you know.
Yeah.
And before it was the loggers, it was the gold miners. And before it was the gold miners, it was the fishermen and the canneries. And, you know, and it just goes, I mean, we could go back to the first Russians when they sent Tartars over to my territories to cut down, you know, certain types of trees that they didn't have in Europe. It's just people taking advantage. You know, like you said, too, like these communities are being systemically attacked, are already vulnerable, already at that disadvantage. And yeah, I think you really hit it on the head with the fire is just like the way in. They've been waiting for something like this, you know, to come in and take what's not theirs in a really tragic and unfortunate way.
Well, I think it's worth mentioning, too, that these fires happened directly because of colonial forces. Fire is not part of the Hawaiian ecosystem, not in this way. I mean, like volcanoes and Pele all is, but wildfire and brush fire, that's not normal for us. You know, it is for other parts. I know South Dakota, like that's part of their ecosystem. But Lahaina used to be a very lush town. So much so, in fact, that, I mean, like I said earlier, it was the kingdom or is the capital of the kingdom of Hawaii for some time, to the point where there was a floating freshwater island. But as these big agricultural industries moved in and redirected the water from the mountains away from the town, it dried up in a way where I was in Maui over this most recent summer. It was hard, like really hard to look at how dry the land had become. It was this direct, you know, colonial agriculture extracted our natural resources that first made Lahaina so vulnerable in the first place. And it's these same colonial forces that we are even more vulnerable to now. I think you could make the comparison that colonialism in Hawaii is like this wildfire. We were already vulnerable to it. And once it happened, it spread and it made everything worse.
Yeah. Thank you. Josh and Kane, you've definitely given us a lot to think about regarding tourism and climate issues and how everything ties into each other. Diving deeper into this topic, the issue of colonialism and its impacts on Indigenous communities is a very significant concern. Can you both talk about how have the Indigenous communities on Maui taken steps to protect their ancestral lands and resources, as well as what can people do further to protect what is there?
Yeah, there is a good amount of protected land on Maui. Like Maui specifically, there's a national park, Haleakala, House of the Sun National Park, but it's frankly not enough. I think the biggest thing that people listening to this should take away from is what they can do, or, you know, things that they can do personally, at the very least to not make things worse, is do not go to Hawaii, and especially do not go to Maui right now. I heard, you know, this past weekend that they're planning on opening that side of the island up pretty soon. And now there's a big concern of people going, you know, to Lahaina to like feel something for themselves. So, you know, don't do that. I think it's people like to have this internal monologue or conversation with themselves where they try to justify their vacations, or they try to see themselves as separate. But the reality is, like, you as an outsider, as Hali, are no different than anyone else who comes to enjoy the resources that have been exploited. There is a lot of, I think, effort to revive our culture. And I think the biggest pieces of our culture that remain are, it's going to be very vague when I say this, but is the aloha, is the willingness to immediately care for everyone. I have an auntie, her name's Sweet Tea, who lives on Oahu, and right after the fires, I mean, she was taking an 8-hour boat ride every day to ferry supplies that, like, she and her community on Oahu just had and raised and donated. And there's been this big just absolute will to help people, even when, like, the government gets in and FEMA gets in and is saying, like, no, like, you can't get past this road or anything, people have just taken their boats around and started handing out supplies, because there's an unwillingness to hurry up and wait when people need help, you know, with our community. And it's something that I'm really proud of, that we are so up and ready to look out for one another.
Yeah, to add to that, I think you really hit it on the head, like, especially there towards the end about Indigenous communities and our willingness to engage in mutual aid and to engage in community support. And, like, going further into that, of course, along with in solidarity, not going to Hawaii, not being a haole, not being a tourist, you know, not contributing to these, like, economics of imperialism. I think another big part too, and this is something that I brought up, or at least in part brought up during the forum, was, you know, cooperation between our communities, especially between the West Coast and the Pacific Northwest and Hawaii. There is, like, a special connection between our peoples as sharing the Pacific Ocean. You know, a lot of Indigenous people who are displaced from Hawaii come to the Pacific Northwest, and they come to my territory. And so, you know, within my nation, we have tons of people who are Skagit, you know, and Hawaiian, or Nooksack and Samoan. And so people who are displaced from the islands find their way here. And so over time, our communities have built these connections. So for us, you know, I haven't necessarily heard much, you know, relating to our support in this particular situation. That's not at all to say that there hasn't. There probably has been reach out from between our communities. It's just something I don't necessarily know as much about at this time. But, you know, we have a history, like, just recently at Puyallup Nation, there was one of the larger traveling canoes. I cannot remember the name of the canoe, but they landed at Puyallup, and the wood that the canoe itself is made out of was donated by Tlingit Haida-up in Alaska, because, you know, in Hawaii itself, because of colonialism, because of resource extraction and some of these issues that we're going into prior, there weren't trees large enough to make some of these traditional traveling canoes. But in the Northwest, we still have some large trees. These ways that we can help each other, even on the level of, you know, like Josh was saying, like, they didn't have it here, but people from Oahu did, and they came over and they stepped up, and having that compassion and having that connection and willingness to, you know, care for our own communities and each other's communities is a big time factor in how Indigenous people will get through this.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's also a little tricky recognizing the shared struggle that the Hawaiians have with the rest of continental Native Americans. Because I see our story so one in the same of American imperialism and manifest destiny that, we really, in that sense, have so much in common. But it's hard because I think a big piece of it is that Native Hawaiians are not a federally recognized tribe. I think we would have more to gain from organizing ourselves enough to be recognized that way. Just in the sense, I think we have more opportunities for protected lands, and it would give us a few more rights, maybe.
What you said there was compelling, because I can definitely see the interest that, like, you would have or other Native Hawaiian community members would have in having those recognitions, treaty statuses, and rights. Because there are a lot of benefits to having a nation recognized, you know, even if sometimes the recognition's a little shoddy. But I guess another thing that what it makes me think about, you know, because I'm from three federally recognized tribes, but I can't enroll in any three of them. And so I do not have any tribal tree protections. You know, my father does, you know, he's enrolled, he's eligible for enrollment. But when you get that federal recognition, it's like, you do gain more control in those ways of, like, you can get protected lands, reservation sites, and those kind of things, but you almost lose internal cohesiveness in your community. And so, you know, because you'll have people arguing over status, like half bloods versus full bloods, quarter bloods versus eighth bloods, you know, because they keep it all on a record and they hold it over your head. And they also will try to make it the status of enrollment and the basis of whether or not you get to exist in your identity and have the legal rights and protections that kind of come with that. And so while I think, like, that's a good idea, I agree. I guess it's important to recognize some of the downfalls of the United States tribal relations system.
One of the big things, one of the, like, biggest, like, talking points about Kanaka sovereignty is a lot of people like to point out, like, there was no treaty of annexation when Taft, I think, annexed the islands. A lot of people point to when it comes to the delegitimate state of Hawaii and or the territory of Hawaii, basically, or anything in regards to the United States owning this land, was that there was no treaty of annexation. But at the same time, the United States never recognizes or respects their treaties or follows them in any way. And I think it's a missed talking point. But at the same time, recognizing ourselves as Indigenous people of the United States of America, even though, you know, we're not in America, but recognizing, you know, how we share these struggles, I think it would give us more direction as to where we can aim ourselves as a people. Blood quantum sucks and is stupid. Yeah, it's a stupid way of organizing a people. I mean, the whole point of blood quantum is drawing a line and saying you're not Native enough. And it's very frustrating when Native people buy into that. There's not enough of us to keep drawing lines between ourselves. We need every drop there is out there circulating. And I think it's just wasted effort to divide ourselves like that.
Yeah, I'm really glad we touched on that point, because recognition is especially in the U.S., is so important in seeing who receives adequate support based off of the census data. And quite frankly, I read up on this recently, but the term AAPI, Asian American Pacific Islander, is a pretty broad term.
Yeah.
That's trying to capture so many diverse people. And especially considering like Pacific Islanders and Asian Americans, Pacific Islanders are indigenous to their group. And then Asian Americans are immigrants coming over. Kind of pushing them all together is in a way saying that ignoring some of the subsets. And sometimes we should question if desegregating this giant group of people might be best in targeting what actually needs to be helped, and what services should be. So I'm very glad that you both touched on that point.
Yeah. And when these movements started, it was more beneficial for, I think, everyone involved to combine these groups, frankly, because there wasn't enough support from either side to really separate them. It's a together we stand kind of thing. And that isn't to say that, you know, it doesn't really work out now. But I think the term Asian American Pacific Islander had its time, and it's just time now for us to move on and keep developing our rights and our movements separately. Yeah, it's definitely something that we've talked about a lot that I have feelings about. But yeah.
Yeah, definitely good to stand in unity. But yeah. In some cases, you also need to have your own stance.
Yeah, okay. Absolutely.
Yeah. So shifting into another question. You both touched on earlier that Maui is a popular destination for tourists, and the wildfire has really caused people to stop and rethink their trips to Maui, as well as what kind of effects that tourism has on local communities and long-term residents. So in the rebuilding of Lahaina, as well as in other indigenous communities, what kind of differences do you hope to see in this rebuilt process?
That's a big question. I think the easiest answer is, you know, an economy that serves the people of Lahaina first and foremost. But having this economic system imposed onto Hawaii has been so detrimental because, in a sense, you've introduced this invasive force, and you've made it a keystone of the area, the local economy. As much as I don't like saying this, just pulling out that keystone is gonna make everything else collapse, and it's something that, frankly, I don't have the solution for. But I do understand that the people of Hawaii and Lahaina, especially Lahaina, have not been put first in their own economies. They exist to serve the people that come in there to enjoy the natural resources that Maui has to offer.
Yeah, I agree with a lot of what you had to say. And I think another good point of discussion on that is not only having it be an economy for the people, but an economy that's sustainable. You know, the tourism industry in Hawaii is based off of space and land. People go there because they want to see this beautiful land and these beautiful beaches and these beautiful waters. But at the end of the day, it's just, there's islands in the middle of the Pacific. There's only so much land to go to, and people got to live there. And, you know, so we have this industry that continually wants to grow infinitely, as many tourists as we could pack on this island safely at a time. Just the land can't take it. I mean, that along with the whole rest of the planet is kind of the root of the problem. I mean, even the root of the fires we have an economic system, like kind of Josh was saying, it's out of our control in many ways because this is the way it's set. And to start removing blocks out of that system is going to cause collapse. The forces of climate change are because we're trying to infinitely grow on a planet that is ultimately finite. We can only pump so many gases into the atmosphere. We can only pull so much from the ground. We can only fish so much out of the ocean. You know, there's only so much that the Earth can give before she buckles. And this is another example of she's struggling, you know. Mother Earth is struggling. And this, you know, these economies of extraction are not sustainable. You know, we need to build economies of reciprocity, if not only for the future of Hawaii, but the future of Earth. it needs to be done. And so, yeah, that's kind of my thought on it.
I think a good starting place would be focusing on foodways, because so much of the land in Hawaii that isn't residential or commercial or anything is agricultural. And I think there is a lot to gain for not just Kanaka Moli, but native and indigenous people everywhere from turning away from these large scale, you know, industrial foodways that have been imposed on us and focusing on reviving our traditional sources of food and bringing them back. When I went to Oahu 2 years ago, I went to this valley with my auntie and her daughter. I think it's called Kaho Olivi or something, where they were growing the old kalo, and they sell it back to the community, and they have these big volunteer days too. Kalo, or taro is the other name for it, is like one of the biggest staples in traditional Hawaiian diet because it's what we use to make poi. And focusing, I think, redirecting agricultural land that has been used to serve people thousands of miles away, you know, and using that land to feed the people who are right there and hungry and on the streets is a great place to start. I think we, Kane and I, also saw this 2 weekends ago. We went up to Nara Wasepi Huron Band of Potawatomi, and we got to help out with the rice camp and participate in their traditional food ways. And it was really impactful to help other indigenous people follow in the footsteps and reconnect with ways that we have been forcibly cut off from. I think that's a great way to redirect the use of the land when rebuilding Lahaina, is to keep that in mind.
Yeah, thank you for sharing.
Yeah.
Pivoting into the next question. So many people around the world do want to help what is currently happening, but might not know how. And after this panel event, PISA, which is the Pacific Islander Student Association, was able to raise $673 for the Maui Strong Fund. What are some other effective ways that you both think people in Bloomington can support recovery efforts to support those who are affected by the Maui wildfires?
I think, honestly, it's hard to help a community impacted by this on the other side of the globe, literally, from here or from wherever you are. I think the biggest thing, the most direct thing that will help is money. And if you can't do that, then don't go to Hawaii. It's easier to not go than it is to go. Just talk about it. I think starting that conversation and just talking about things that are happening helps people recognize bigger patterns that are happening around the world.
Yeah, I 100% agree with that. You know, education is the most important thing that anyone can do before any kind of political action or any kind of, you know, mutual aid. You know, we need to know what the causes are of our problems on a larger scale, seeing these larger patterns, if we want to do anything effective. Because, you know, if you don't know that the problem in Lahaina is colonialism mixed with capitalist extractive economics destroying the planet, you might just go around saying, whatever, you know, send more cops in there. Maybe they can do some work in there. And you're gonna completely miss the point of what the help was supposed to be. You're a member of the community. That's not what you're going to want. And so, yeah, that importance of education before action, you know, so we're not accidentally sending a bunch of imperialists when we need to be sending, you know, community members. We need to be sending mutual aid. We need to be sending communities that are rooted primarily in the interests of the community, first and foremost, and that needs to be known. In addition to that, as far as money goes, there was a great Instagram shared at the forum, Lahaina Ohana Venmo. It basically allows you to go and directly give money to families who post on the page. And it's just a direct to community.
Great. Thank you, Kane, and thank you, Josh, for sharing and taking the time to talk on this podcast and shed a personal perspective on what is currently happening right now. Thank you for listening to this week's episode of Hereabouts, Asian American Midwest Radio. Hereabouts is produced by WFHB Community Radio and Indiana University's Asian Culture Center. We ask critical questions about identity, culture, community, and shared assumptions. We air every other Wednesday from 5:30 to 6:30 in the evening. Please stay tuned for future episodes. This was Molly Tai, and I hope you enjoyed this week's episode.